Welcome to Hustle Up's The Big Break, where we talk to showrunners, directors, executives, and other talented people working in the entertainment industry about how they got their start and what they've done to fast forward their creative careers. I'm H. Schuster, the founder and CEO of Hustle Up, and now an aspiring podcaster. We'll see how this goes, but I haven't quit my day job yet. And today I'm chatting with Fenton Bailey, an incredibly talented Emmy Award-winning producer of film and television, scripted and documentary. Join us for this episode of Hustle Up's The Big Break. Fenton Bailey is an Emmy Award-winning executive producer who co-founded and co-runs World of Wonder, a prolific production company based in Los Angeles, and an early Hustle Up partner. For three decades, World of Wonder has reshaped international pop culture, earning 26 Emmys and inspiring Oscar-winning performances. Programming highlights include Emmy Award-winning RuPaul's Drag Race, Million Dollar Listing, LA and New York, award-winning films and documentaries including Party Monster, Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, Inside Deep Throat, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and Emmy-winning Out of Iraq. Fenton and Randy, his partner, created YouTube channel Wow Presents and launched global SVOD platform Wow Presents Plus across 190 territories. Wow also operates RuPaul's DragCon, the world's largest all-ages drag culture convention, welcoming over 100,000 attendees, music label World of Wonder Records, and the Wow Podcast Network. And Fenton and Randy have been honored for trailblazing work with the IDA Pioneer Award, Real Screen's Global 100, Variety's Reality Leaders List, and Reality TV Impact Report, as well as the Out 100. And most recently, World of Wonder was ranked number 2 among film and TV powerhouses in Fast Company's World's 50 Most Innovative Companies. Okay, I'm not going to lie, I feel like a little bit of an underachiever right now. Welcome, Fenton Bailey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and thanks for that amazing introduction.
I think what's really interesting is that you and Randy started World of Wonder in the early 90s when, you know, documentary and unscripted episodic was still in sort of the TV womb, right? Real World had premiered, but reality TV was still, coming into its own. What really drew you to this nascent genre back then?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because sometimes you really don't know why you do something. And because in some respects, it was quite a bleak prospect. But, the worst word was the D word, the documentary word. But for some reason, Randy and I were just drawn to it. And I suppose one of the big sort of inflection, well, the very first thing really was public access television. I think that was something I certainly had never seen, coming from England where there were only 4 channels. The idea that anyone could have their own TV show, make it themselves and have it on TV, that was an amazing thing. And public access was this sort of, that public access was the reason why you could do that. And it came out of the evolution of
cable. It was the Wild West. Anybody could have access.
Anybody could have access. In return for people controlling the cable channels in a neighborhood, they were required by government to allow 1 or 2 channels for the community, for anyone to make any kind of show they wanted.
This is making Gen Zers' heads explode right now, because that was our access to the bandwidth.
Right.
And now with YouTube, YouTube is public access TV,
YouTube is. Insta stories is, TikTok is. The idea of you not being able to make your own stuff is so alien, it's hard to imagine a time or an environment where you couldn't do that. And that's what public access was. And those shows were so punk. They were do-it-yourself shows made for next to nothing. They didn't care about advertisers. There were no advertisers. So they were free to be completely radical. And that was the sort of bright and shiny thing that attracted me and Randy. And so the first show we ever did was a public access show we made ourselves called Flaunt It TV. And it was a talk show. And we filmed it at the Limelight Nightclub in New York. And we quickly realized that being in front of the camera wasn't where we wanted to be necessarily.
I don't want to date myself, but I remember Flaunt It. I remember it.
Yeah. I mean, oh my God. I mean, we are like literally dinosaurs here.
You guys made a lot of really interesting early projects. I mean, you know, some of the shows that you produced and sold, like I remember right after the LA riots, you gave a cross section of Angelino's cameras to shoot their own experiences, right? And this was before anybody had an iPhone, anybody had the ability to just, like you said, go and make content. Like, how did you come up with that idea? How did you sort of generate your ideas that were really inventing this unscripted genre?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think the LA riots was definitely, after public access, the LA riots were the next thing that really shaped us. Because, you know, thinking back to that Rodney King tape of Rodney, you know, being beaten by the police, that videotape that was seen around the world, Randy and I remember seeing that for the first time and thinking, oh my God, you know, we'd all heard about police brutality and the like. And of course, there had been the Zapruder footage of Kennedy being assassinated.
Yeah.
But this was so, it was almost like not since then, the Zapruder footage, had there been anything as shocking and as clarifying. Yeah. And it was all because one guy, Reginald Halliday, got out his video camera and taped it from his bathroom window at his condo. He just looked, he heard all this commotion, looked out, got out his video camera and taped it. And he actually went to the police with his tape and said, look, here's, I've got this tape. They didn't respond to him.
Yeah.
And so he went to KCOP, the local LA news station, and it was everywhere. And that showed us, it wasn't our idea in a way, I think it showed us that there was a video revolution happening. And it was a year later, of course, after the jury in Simi Valley found Rodney King, the police who assaulted him, not guilty,
yeah,
that the riots happened. And so that was our sort of, wow, we were thinking, gosh, all this because one person hit record on their videotape recorder. Also, it was the same time that these Hi8 all-in-one camcorders were coming on the market. And these were prosumer. They were, for the first time, even though they were tiny video cassettes, 8mm, they were broadcast quality. And that was another huge leap forward. And the last thing is that the BBC were very innovative. They've been doing this series called Video Diaries, where they'd given, you know, had people tell their own stories. And we thought, gosh, couldn't we do this in not a bigger way, but just in a more epic way, I suppose, of like, yeah, capturing the whole vibe of LA by giving camcorders. We gave them to gang leaders, someone who was running for mayor, an LA Times reporter, two cops, Zoe Ter, who was then a helicopter news reporter. So we had this cross-section of Los Angelinos and made this three-hour documentary. Only would the BBC ever let you do that, especially since Randy and I had hardly made anything before that point, you know? So
it's interesting. You're British.
Yeah.
How would you distinguish making content for British companies and broadcasters versus here in the US? Mm-hmm. Especially now with all the streamers and proliferation of outlets, although now we're seeing some contraction. Is there a significant difference between the kind of content being bought and made in the UK versus here in the US? Or is it a global business now?
That's a really good question. I mean, I do think Randy and I in World of Wonder was so lucky that we started doing what we did when we did it, because there was a sort of window, magical window, which I don't think does exist anymore. But at the time, BBC was pretty innovative, but also they had to be, because also created around this time was Channel 4, Britain's fourth channel, which was sort of partly commercial, but partly state owned. And it was created specifically to give unheard voices, minority voices, excluded voices, a shot and some sort of platform. And I do think it was only because of that that we were able to get anything away. And that Channel 4 were the people who commissioned our first series, Manhattan Cable, which was all this public access compilation show from New York's public access shows. And so there was a mandate for innovation in TV that I don't think has really it's harder for that to exist in a completely commercial environment. Yeah. And not to knock PBS, but I think it's had a harder time being innovative than what was almost required to be innovative in British TV at that time. It's not like that anymore. And I do think that, you know, I'm not sure that the advent of streaming has been so good for innovative content. But on the other hand, you have YouTube. You have anyone now can be a creator. So there's no, it's not like people are excluded in the way that they were before. Because I do think super great ideas do have a way of finding an audience, you know?
That's right. That's right. And you know, it's interesting because you guys have been able to move between sort of highbrow featured docs like Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, and Wona Robitz, one of my favorite artists of all time, and then soapy series like Million Dollar Listing. How have you kind of been able to create a company that's able to move, you know, across different sort of genres and tastes, right?
Well, I think it's partly the directors and the showrunners we work with. I mean, when I say partly, it's a lot to do with that. But also, I think really in the world of unscripted, it's really all about storytelling. And so the differences between different genres tend to get sort of exaggerated and people get pigeonholed as like, oh, well, you do this, so you can't do that. But really, it's all storytelling. And you can tell a story in lots of different ways. And I think Rennie and I really love that you don't have to do it the same way all the time. And I think that a good story is a good story. And there's so many different ways to tell it. You know, like one of the things we did recently was we worked on Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill. So Ronan writes the sort of one of the stories that breaks open the Harvey Weinstein case, and it was published in the New Yorker. So he does that, then he writes the book, the bestseller Catch and Kill. Then he did a podcast, Catch and Kill, and then HBO came to us and said, "Oh, we've got these tapes because they videotaped a couple of interviews for the Catch and Kill podcast. Could you do something with them?" And it was at the time of, we were all in lockdown, so you couldn't just get a crew and go shoot. And we thought, oh, well, this would be really interesting. And a challenge to turn something that's audio only into a visual series. And by using archive and sort of atmospheric B-roll, or sort of recree and those interviews, it just came out great. So in the end, even though Ronan is telling the same story, he's telling it like five different times.
And in different mediums, right?
It's, yeah. Exactly. It's not exactly the same. It's different in each iteration. And I think that shows what an amazing time it is right now to be able to tell almost any story anyway.
Well, you guys have had the really interesting and enviable opportunity to produce scripted stories based on true stories like Party Monster and Eyes of Tammy Faye, right? Which is another sort of way in which you can tell a story multiple ways through sort of a documentary lens or a scripted lens. I'm curious, you know, how did, and particularly Eyes of Tammy Faye, it took a long time, right, for that to go from the documentary you made in what, like 2000, right, to becoming the feature film that was, you know, a huge success for Jessica Chastain's career and so forth. What was sort of the process for that of winding up making a scripted film about that?
Yeah, you know, I want to tell some amazing story that shows how carefully we planned it and figured it out. But the truth is slightly different. You know, we loved making The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and Tammy Faye was such an amazing, I you know, sometimes you think about, well, why do you do anything? And really meeting and knowing Tammy and having the opportunity to learn from her was the best gift. But after we made that documentary, we then made Tammy Faye Death Defying with director Chris McKim, which was when Tammy was diagnosed with the return of her cancer, and she thought it was going to be terminal. It turned out not to be in that time frame. So that's why it was called Tamiflu Death Defying. And then we made a series about her son, Jay Baker. But in all that time, we had hoped that we could make a movie, but to be honest, we had thought it would never happen. You know, I think it's a bit like that with Drag Race. We had thought that Drag Race would never happen because we'd pitched it many times and it was always no. And so to be honest, we didn't do a great deal in pursuing it. It was Jessica Chastain who came to us and said, I'd like to, you know, acquire the rights and make a movie. We were like, really? You know, because we'd seen Jessica in Zero Dark Thirty, and she's an amazing actress.
Phenomenal.
But just not necessarily what we imagined Tammy to, an actress playing Tammy. Maybe Jean Smart, but not Jessica, you know? We met Jessica, and she was incredibly smart and charming. And I just love that she wanted to make it the movie of the documentary, that's what she wanted, because she could have made a Tammy Faye movie, you know, and it was amazing that she did that. And I think she understood what Tammy was about, because her performance of Tammy, it's not just an actor doing a great performance, which it is, it's sort of a full, it's like when a drag queen does a great lip sync, it's something more than a performance, it's a connection. You kind of can't tell the difference between the two.
It's filled with empathy. It's a really empathetic performance.
And I just get goosebumps, because to this day, I love that Jessica won the Oscar for Best Performance. And I also love it won for Best Hair and Makeup, because Tammy Faye was ridiculed her entire life for her makeup. Yeah. And people never really understood what Tammy was doing. And so I feel that Oscar is Tammy's Oscar. And I think Jessica would say the same, actually. It's about, you know, what Jessica says, it's a radical act of love. You know, Tammy said, you know, I don't label people. We're all dirt made out of the same old, we're all junk, we're all, God doesn't, what is it? I don't label people. We're all made out of the same old dirt, and God doesn't make any junk. And whether you believe in God or not, that's immaterial. It's that.
She believed in God and she said that, right? So that's the beauty of it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's the truth. It's a sort of radical love, which is a sort of true egalitarianism. Yeah. And I think that Jessica won the movie won those two Oscars is the best vindication for Tammy Faye ever, especially those Oscars, because remember the best actor, the whole thing, when that happened, no one was paying any attention to the rest of the Oscar cast after Will Smith punched.
That's right. It was very distracting, shall we say. That's right. Yeah.
But what a perfect contrast, you know, in contrast to that toxic masculinity, Jessica gets up and channels Tammy Faye, because her speech was so moving.
It was.
And She spoke to us, she spoke to the LGBTQ community, it was just a wonderful thing.
That's an amazing moment for you guys too. It's really an incredible validation of the work you're doing, right? That it takes this long to get it to the screen, and then, you know, to see an actress like that have such passion for the role and be rewarded for that, be recognized for that. It's really phenomenal. And I mean, that's sort of an interesting segue into my sort of question about your work with RuPaul, right? Because you started working with RuPaul in the early 90s and eventually launched the juggernaut series RuPaul's Drag Race, which has been going now for, 15 seasons. It has, like, you know, a million Emmys, 2 million spinoffs. It's a global hit. And it's a massive accomplishment. And I love the story that I've heard you tell about how the show started out being really pigeonholed as something that only an LGBTQ audience would care about, right? And I'd love to, you know, like, you know, talk to you about that and hear more about how you guys were able to grow this franchise despite sort of that resistance on the side of perhaps the buyer or the broadcaster.
Well, you know, I was just at the Asian Television Festival in Singapore, and I was on a panel, and the panel was, will my IP succeed internationally? So it was a bunch of producers, and it was a great panel, and they asked everybody a question. And then the question I was asked was like, well, how is it making LGBTQ content? And I said, look, you know, yes, it's made by a bunch of gays. Yes, we're gay. We make it. And yes, it's filled with drag queens. And so there's no question that there's a large amount of LGBTQ in the show. And then I said, but the thing is, it's not an exclusive LGBTQ show. It never has been. And I think that to some extent, the perception that it is has created this sort of misunderstanding that it's niche. And I think niche is a word that always gets me going from 0 to 60. I've heard it all my career, and we'll probably hear it for all my life. But because it sort of implies that this something can only be of interest to a very few people. And yet, you know, time and again, the biggest hits come from being niche rather than trying to be all. It's the stuff that tries to be all things to all people that has been so carefully manufactured according to market research by networks and algorithms and all the data in the world telling them what people have done. By definition, it's like, well, why is what people have done going to define what people will do? All looking in the rearview mirror can tell you is about the past, which is surely is not the way to look for innovation in the future. But time and time again, if you go in with something that is outside of that algorithmic database, they're like, yeah, it won't work, or yeah, you know, I remember music.
No one's done this before, therefore the answer is no, right?
Computer says no.
It's interesting that niche has become like a bad word, because in fact, like, the specificity of someone's story is the thing that makes it interesting to us, right?
Exactly. I mean, you know, Rue says you're born naked and the rest is drag. And we are all born naked. Everybody is born naked. And so everything we're wearing is also by definition some kind of statement about who we feel we are or who we want to be. We're telling a story with what we wear, and that is drag. And so point being that drag is a universal thing.
That's right. Everybody can relate to putting on clothes that make you feel a certain way, right?
Yes.
And putting on.
Right. Some people are putting on armor. Some people are putting on something that reveals themselves. And when you see the queens in the workroom and they share their stories, whether it's about rejection or about addiction or just struggling, those stories are, everybody can relate to those stories. Those aren't exclusive LGBTQ stories. They're universal. So that's what we're sort of always trying to get across, that it's that even though it may be a very specific thing, as you've said, it's universal, it's sort of relatable. And I think meeting Rue was, in our story, the other great thing. Randy and I were in Atlanta performing. Randy and I had a band, the Pop Tarts, and we were performing in Atlanta, and Dick Richards, who's no longer with us, was taking us around and turned the corner, and there was RuPaul putting up posters advertising himself, and they were like, RuPaul is everything. And just, we were like, yes, yes.
And this was in the era of Wigstock, which was probably still happening in Tompkins Square Park.
Yeah.
And there was this explosion of drag culture and drag queens, you know, finally taking the main stage and saying, this is who we are. This is how we perform. You know, look at us. And they were coming out of the clubs and sequestered spaces where their performance had been happening.
Mm. And it was this sort of East Village drag, which was, I think, a break with another idea of drag. But this sort of idea of drag was very taking all of pop culture and putting it into the mix. It wasn't really about gender at all. It was about understanding that we're in this sort of media age and we're bombarded by advertisements and TV shows and billboards and magazines, and it's all coming at you. And drag was kind of, I always felt, a response to that. On the one hand, mocking celebrity and making fun of things, but also loving them at the same time, celebrating them at the same time. It was sort of a great, a nod and a wink that we were...
Pop culture as a whole, right? This sort of pastiche that celebrated it, but also had a critical eye or a commentary, right?
Absolutely, yes.
It's really interesting. I mean, I'm curious what you think, you know, in terms of LGBTQ programming and diversity more generally. Do you think the industry is becoming more diverse behind the camera and in its programming choices than it used to be? What are the challenges today for, you know, diverse creatives or people who want to tell diverse stories?
Yeah. Well, I do think you're right that it is changing and that there are more opportunities. I also think, to sort of say the quiet part out loud, that pop culture is queer culture. And it actually kind of has been. It may have been undercover or not really acknowledged.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, whether it's Madonna or whether it's the White Lotus or Hacks or, I mean, it's all so gay, you know? And I do think that that's the sort of brilliant thing, is that camp as a medium is sort of something that can go undercover, in meaning that by virtue of not being taken seriously, by being considered marginal, it can actually do incredible amount of work. Can really infect the mainstream in a way that mainstream doesn't really know it's being infected.
Covertly operating.
Yes. I mean, I've just written this book, Screen Age, and it comes out in the States in March. And it's all about, you know, how TV has changed our reality. And one of the moments in it that for me was just another sort of milestone was when Madonna, at the halftime show, comes onto the field of the Super Bowl to Vogue. It is the gayest, campus, queerest thing you ever saw in your life. And yet here we are on the sort of sacred ground of heterosexuality. And it's like a Trojan horse. It's like, so in a way, it's like, it's no bad thing to be undercover. I'm not arguing for the closet at all. That's terrible and repressive. But sometimes being underestimated, or, you know, it can be a good thing in the ability.
That coding that happens can work its way into places that might not otherwise allow it.
Right. Suppose Mike White had said, I want to make a diverse drama. You know, if he'd pitched it as a diverse piece of work, maybe executives would have found reasons to say no. But instead, it's like, well, here's this aspirational, dark, however he pitched it. I have no idea how he pitched it. But, you know, and it ends up being incredibly, incredibly queer.
Transgressive, like, right? Transgressive compared to some of the other HBO Max or HBO shows. I'm curious because your book, which you mentioned is coming out in March, is essentially your love letter to TV. What role did TV play for you growing up as a queer kid?
Right. Well, two things, you know, because growing up as a queer kid, I was the last to know. And I'm sure that's the case for many a young gay person.
I'm pretty sure I was the first to know. I just didn't tell anybody
really?
Else.
Like, how did you know? How did you know?
I don't know. You know, I can remember from the youngest age, like always imagining myself as like the boy in the picture, because that was the only thing I had access to, right? Was if I want to kiss the girl, then I must be the boy. And so therefore I imagine myself as the boy in the picture. And I can remember practicing kissing my rub-a-dub dolly, which, you know, she wasn't a great date. I'm not going to lie, but, you know, from a very young age. And, you know, it's funny to me that my wife, who is across the room, is now, her head is in her hands. She's like, I can't believe you're telling me a story. But you know, it's funny because like, I looking back on it, I can't believe my parents or other people around me didn't know, although it was a different time. Right.
They knew. No. Here's the thing. They knew. They just weren't going to say anything to you. And that's what I mean about being the last to know, because all these people around us know, but they adapt their behavior. And the last thing they're going to do is tell us, let us in on the secret. For example, my sort of cringeworthy story is Batman and Robin, the TV series, which I still love to this day, but loved then. I'd never seen anything like it. And something about it just attracted me, like bright and shiny. I remember buying a plastic Batman and a plastic Robin at the toy store and trying to scrape off Robin's underpants because I wanted to see what was under them. So you know.
Not anatomically correct, I'm guessing.
I wasn't successful, but it was like, it wasn't until much, much later that I really figured out, oh, I'm queer. In fact, it was TV. It was a TV show that the penny dropped. It was this drama, made for TV drama called The Naked Civil Servant, about Quentin Crisp, who I had never heard of, but he was this sort of very outrageous, flamboyant, queer character in Britain in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Perhaps the worst time to be, you know, and gay. And I watched this drama and John Hurt played him. And at the end of it, Quentin Crisp moves to New York. And I swear to you, that was like, oh, I was 16. I was like, that's what I have to do. I have to get to New York. Somehow everything will be okay if I can get to New York. And it was really when I realized I was queer and that the only way forward for me was to leave England.
Yeah.
And yeah, there were queer people in England, of course, but I just didn't feel I was free to live the life I wanted to live.
There wasn't enough distance from everything else, right? You needed to start fresh.
Yes. And a feeling of needing to get out of that. Just, I think, the shadow of some sort of judgment. Yes, there was gay liberation, but it wasn't really, you know, it hadn't really taken, well, it had taken root, but just that sense that I just had to get away. And I'm sure it was because I was queer and really sort of recognized that.
The fresh start, right? Well, that's the perfect segue into the question I have to ask you, because, you know, it's the name of our show. What was your big break moment or moments? Like, at what point did you realize I'm going to be a television producer, a content creator? And how did you kind of start to make the moves into that?
I think that, you know, chance favors the prepared, which means would imply that somehow you have to organize yourself. But all I knew is I had to get to New York, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was reading English at university, and I hadn't really thought about my career. But my roommate was the son of a very successful television executive. And so she was putting pressure on him to know what he was going to do. And he was applying for this scholarship that basically paid everything to go to the States. You could go to a number of different colleges and you just had to sort of state your case. And he was like, you're never going to get this. No one's going to get it. Cause it's, I mean, what an amazing opportunity to, everything's paid for like 2 years. You get living money or your tuition's paid for. So I applied and he applied.
I want to apply for that now, frankly.
Right. I applied and he applied and I got it. And wow. I mean, that was my big break. I mean, really, like, because there was no way I could have gone to America otherwise. And
that's amazing. So you went to New York.
Went to NYU film school. First day there, I met Randy. So, you know.
Unbelievable. Now that's serendipity. The first part is you were a great student with a great application and you earned the scholarship. But then the other piece of it, meeting Randy, that is complete serendipity, right? How do you
plan exactly, for that? Exactly. And you know, Randy's been, we were lovers first and then, you know, we were partners and we're still business partners today, you know, so, yeah, I don't know how you plan. I mean, not only that, but Randy and I were actually in separate classes and Arnie Baskin took one look at both of us and said, you're going to be in my class. And he moved me from the class I was put into and put me in the class with Randy and with Arnie as the teacher. I mean, like, how is that? That is the most random, weird thing, you know?
And so then how long did it take you guys to start making things for public access? Like, what was the process of you guys meeting and then deciding we're actually going to like start a business together?
Okay, so we were at film school and we were like, well, how are we ever going to make movies? Because, you know, the independent film business wasn't that we know about from Harvey Weinstein and Killer Films and all, you know, that amazing Sundance period. That hadn't happened yet. And we were like, the way to, this is so insane, the way to us to make movies will be if we form a band, have some hits, use the money from that to make movies. I mean, what kind of illogic, like, I have no musical ability. I cannot sing, I cannot dance, I cannot play an instrument. Randy can, actually, Randy can sing and play an instrument. But it was like...
And this was the Pop-Tarts, right?
This was the Pop-Tarts. And we weren't very successful, but... But, you know, we did meet Rue and, you know, what a life-changing thing that has proved to be. And we did actually end up having a hit, by the way. I have to clarify this because our first single was called New York City Beat and it went straight to, it did nothing, you know. But then years later, 25 years later, Armand Van Helden sampled the entire song and had a huge hit with it in Europe. And one day we were going to bed and we saw the trailer for Don't Mess With The Zohan.
Yep.
And we're like, that's our song in the trailer. it's like, how can that be? And turns out, yes, Armand Van Helden, bless him, had sampled our entire single and made it much better, of course, and had a hit with it. And so... Yeah, so there you go.
Just keeps the fact that you never know, right? You put content out there. And I think this is interesting for people today, for sort of young creators who are just making a lot of stuff and putting it out there, right? And you don't know what might happen, right? And part of it is finding great collaborators, right? How do you guys go about finding great people to work with? What's your process?
I think, you know, with Randy and myself, it's like we sort of somehow, and we argue so much when we're doing so, we're like, bah, 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 bah. But we recognize
the
that
arguing makes it better.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never admit that, but it does. And sometimes like two pairs of eyes is better than one, you know. Plus I think it can be lonely if you're doing your own thing and putting it's, you know, and there's a lot of rejection and so much 99% is rejection. But all you really need is one person to say, yes, this is a good idea. I'm going to do it. You know, you just need one person to see it. And so I would just say the answer is just be open. And also, I think it sounds weird to say, but not too controlling in the sense of no one's perfect. But I think, so you can sometimes maybe try too hard or look too hard for the perfect person and just see what comes to you. And I think that we like to say no is the beginning of yes, because you're going to hear no so much and it can be really discouraging. And it is discouraging, but let's admit it is really discouraging, which is why having a partner in your collaborative, in your process can be just nice, because you can sort of have a pity party with someone else, you know, like, And then just remember, it's you only need one person at a record company or a film company or at a TV channel, just one person. So who cares what the other 1,000 that they say no?
That's right.
You just got to find one person.
That's exactly right. And you know, so many of us know that no is the second best answer to yes, right? Because the worst is when you get left in that limbo of like, well, maybe if you do a little more work over here, you tweak it over here, and you're sort of chasing that tail and going in circles, and you know, you still don't get the yes, right?
Yeah, in LA, people hate to say no, don't they? It's the like least used word. It's like it took me a while to figure that out. Like, we'd leave pitch meetings and be like, oh my God, that was so great. You know, they said they love this idea. They don't see any reason why not to do it. And they're going to do it. And then you're like 6 months later, like, what?
And then that executive's not even there anymore. They've left. Yeah. Right. Yeah. How do you think documentary filmmaking, reality film, television making, how has it changed over the last 30 years? Is there just more of it, more places to sell it? You know, is it harder because of budgets? Like, what do you think are the biggest differences between now and when you started out?
Well, I think, yes. I mean, one of the biggest differences is there's so many more places to go, which I often thought, oh, this is going to be great. There's so many more channels and outlets and places. I, funnily enough, found that there's more no's than ever before. And the weird thing is that even though there are more places, everybody seems to be chasing the same thing, mm-hmm. which means that the opportunity, I thought more places means more different stuff, but actually more places by and large means more of the same. So
it's interesting. Everybody wants to jump on the same bandwagon. It's the lemming effect, I suppose.
Yes. It's still the eye of the needle is still the same size, and somehow you've got to get your camel through it. And, but
no camels were hurt in the recording of this podcast.
Right.
No,
but, on the other hand, the sort of just do it yourself principle is that's really where the opportunity lies, because now there's no barrier, none of those barriers to entry. I think the other thing is that, you know, reality TV then didn't exist, I suppose, and mm-hmm. and was terribly, I mean, I think TV generally as a medium has been maligned for most of its life. And now we have premium TV and people look at it differently. But even so, people still look down on TV in terms of reality, I think, and unscripted.
Yep.
And yet I do think it's the sort of front line of innovation, actually. I think it's where the most innovative work takes place.
Because you can make things more quickly for less money, so you can take more shots at it, right? And in theory, do interesting things that break lots of conventions, right? Which is what you guys were doing at the very beginning of the genre.
Exactly. And there are so many ways now to tell a story in an unscripted sense. You know, it's so great. There aren't really any of the rules that there used to be about documentaries. You know, the business of storytelling or the sort of challenge of it is to make it as engaging and as interesting and as compelling as possible. And that stuff's just good storytelling. And it doesn't matter whether someone's lip syncing the interview or you've got a recree. To me, all these things are more crayons to use to paint the picture.
Yep, I agree. Well, let's talk about painting the picture. I thought we could switch it up and I could ask you about some of the TV you love to watch.
Right.
And so I'm curious, what are you watching right now?
Well, right. Let's not talk about White Lotus because it's talked about so much and
yes.
Rightly so. I mean, you know, it's amazing.
Mike White is a genius.
Yeah. No question. Interesting little fact is his dad used to be Nixon's speechwriter, mm-hmm. and then he left Nixon at the White House and became Falwell's spokesperson.
Yep,
Jerry Falwell. And we interviewed his dad in the Eyes of Tammy Faye documentary.
That's right, I remember that.
That's how I know Mike, through his dad, who came out as gay. So the whole thing is like amazing.
Mike's dad is probably the most interesting character he hasn't written about yet, but I imagine that's coming.
That's absolutely fascinating and a lovely, lovely guy. Watch The Crown.
Okay.
All the seasons. And I know people have different views about the last season, but, and I have to say the first two episodes, I was like, nope, not feeling it. It's miscast. They seem to have lost the plot. But then by the time I watched all five, all 10 episodes, I thought it was pretty good. So, The Crown.
I mean, let's face it, you know, as an Englishman, you kind of have to watch The Crown, don't you? Right. Just as a gatekeeper, if nothing else.
Yes. Well, right. But I have to say, I do tend to watch a lot of scripted. I think it's because it's like sometimes watching unscripted feels a bit like I'm in the office watching a cut, you know, and just
it's interesting, right? Because I talk to scripted folks who are like, oh, I watch all unscripted, right? They want to watch real people ostensibly doing real things. They want to get away from kind of the work they do all day. And then same thing, you talk to unscripted producers and they're like, oh, I want to watch a scripted show. I want to sort of, you know, I think people want, they crave the thing they're not making, right?
That is true to an extent, but I also think scripted folks are looking for ideas. And they're like looking for shit they can rip off.
No. I'm curious, is there an unscripted series in 2022 that you guys did not make that you were really like, wow, this is great. This is a really good series.
Yes, I'm trying to think. Let me think about that.
I will say that I recently watched We Need to Talk About Cosby, the Kamau Bell series about Cosby. And I thought it was very interesting, the approach he took and how they told the story. It was definitely worth watching and really well done, I think, in terms of exploring that topic.
I got to watch that. I'm excited to watch that. Have you watched Senior?
No, I have not.
It's amazing. I'm not completely done with it, but it's like Robert Downey Jr. and his dad. And they're making, Robert Downey Jr. wants to make this documentary about his dad. And his dad, who has been an independent filmmaker most of his life,
right,
has a different idea and wants to make his version. And it's this sort of struggle for control of the narrative that ends up being incredibly amazing and revealing. You know,
that's really interesting. That's really interesting. I have to check it out. I have not seen that. And I'm curious in terms of features, you know, what have you loved this year? Have you gone to the theater to see anything?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Let me think what I did go to see. It's so funny because I was more aware of being in a theater almost than what I was watching.
Yeah. We went to see a screening of She Said, which I thought was brilliantly done. I have to say, She Said, all of the performances were amazing and the score was phenomenal. I mean, you know, oftentimes scores, I think, get under credited for creating the mood of a film and telling the story. And I thought the score was really wonderful of that film. But sitting in the theater, I was acutely aware of being in a theater and you know, most people were masked, but still it was interesting.
I saw Bros in the theater and I loved it. I know that's not, you know, not everyone loved it, but I thought it was great. I also, this is an unpopular opinion perhaps, but I love the MCU. And yeah. I just think what they have done is so spectacular. It's sort of almost beyond comprehension of taking all of those characters and then having a plan of like, we'll do this and then we'll do this and then we'll do this. And then we'll do TV series and movie. It's like, just to see how, because I think before Marvel, superhero movies, comic book movies, they were okay, but you always felt that they were kind of schlocky and they just weren't that good.
Yeah, the storytelling was lacking, right?
Yeah, and I think once Marvel took control of their own destiny and said, no, we're not gonna partner with this one or that one, we're gonna do it ourselves, suddenly you got these really fresh, unapologetic storylines, incredibly well-crafted, brilliantly funny and sort of dry and droll and knowing and meta, you know, like, you know, Taika Waititi's Thor, Ragnarok. I thought it was just a stunning piece of work. And also, by the way, totally queer, you know, like
I see a theme emerging.
Yeah. And I think that, I know people are like, oh, it's too much, and Loki, the TV series Loki, I think it's just so incredible. So
it'll be interesting to see if Warner Brothers Discovery is trying to empower the DC team to do the same thing, to tell better stories. It remains to be seen.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, canceling Batgirl or Batwoman,
And now Wonder Woman, right? So
I'm not quite, I don't know.
It's very interesting. Well, alas, I think we are almost out of time, Fenton. It has been wonderful to chat with you, and thank you for sharing your big break story with us. Your career is seriously inspiring. I need to get out more and do more cool stuff, like, right away. It's amazing.
Well, and thank you for what you're doing with Hustle Up. I think it's a brilliant idea, and it's something we all really need, because, you know, putting together those kind of creatives and people, there just isn't enough of that. I guess we all end up living in our own silos, and so not, you know, it's really desperately needed. So
Thank you. That's one of the reasons why that's our tagline, which my wife wrote. I have to give her credit or I'll wind up getting divorced. We're trying to transform Hollywood's old click, CLIQUE, with one click.
That's good. I want a t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get you a t-shirt. Here's the t-shirt right here. But we really appreciate World of Wonder joining us and your support for what we're building. It's really exciting to see you guys and many other production companies and studios get excited about, you know, what we're trying to do. And by the way, sneak peek, we're going to be launching the laptop and desktop version of the app in the next 4 weeks. So there's going to be a much easier way for our production partners to get in and search for talent, which is going to
be love that. It's not technology, it's clicknology.
That's right. It's clicknology. All right. Now I'm stealing that one, but giving you credit. That's good. Well, that's it for this episode of Hustle Up's The Big Break. Please join us for future episodes featuring production company CEOs, producers, writers, and more. Our theme music for this episode was composed by Hustle Up member Lewis Robert King, and we'll be featuring different themes from other Hustle Up composers in future episodes. If you like what you hear, let us know, and thanks so much for listening.